Good evening, everybody.
Good evening. Good evening.
You look a little weary. Good evening, maybe. You don't look so weary. But it doesn't mean you aren't. Oh, again, I need to borrow. Oh, they're right here already. Thank you. Do you have that light? I think so, and if I don't, I can just pull one of these over. Thanks. So last night, we talked about the first of the four pieces I want to be bringing in. So just to situate us, I'll review those. I'll say them again. Yeah. So the framework of what I'm bringing for us to play with during this week is something gleaned from the Lankavatara Sutra, which became really emblematic of our school. That the Lankavatara Sutra came to be seen, has come to be seen, still is, as maybe the central foundational sutra of our Zen school. And it includes many things, but the framework that I'm bringing from it is the teaching that we are anointed on our foreheads by our ancestors, blessed and welcomed and touched and given a mission, really, comes with that, I think. That intimate and tender a giving. And second, that our vows have the power that we need. That we can, our way, our practice of a way, our lives can be powered by our vows. Third, that with this power and with the blessings that we have received and receive from all around, right? Because everyone is our ancestor, as well as our descendant, and our lover, and our mother, right? With that blessing, and with the power of our vows under us, this fundamental energy of transformation, we can release, abandon, let loose our hold on the habit energy of beginningless projection, our projecting an image of this onto it from forever and continually. That we can release our hold on that projection, which is not to say we stop it from happening. We can stop believing it. Yeah. We can stop relating to it instead of relating to what's actually happening. And when we do that, we step forward on the bare ground of this moment and this place ready to respond. In which case, we are able to fulfill our core vow as human beings that we just all carry within us, that vow to be helpful, that vow to all wake together. So that's the big idea. And so last night we talked about that first part, the ancestors, and brought in the devil girl, who so much is our ancestor in the energy of her vow, right? We didn't really talk about that, but you can feel it. It's not stated. She just doesn't stop for anything, right? And that's kind of the feel of the energy of vow, right? Ain't nothing gonna stop that girl from getting in there. And so, and she does enter, and in fact, you get the feeling at the end of the story, she doesn't even necessarily need to. You know, she's saying, look, you don't have it, you have it, you're fine, you know. It's like, why exactly did she need to go in there? So that blessing, you know, we're blessed by that example. And I have a PS from last night. I learned just this evening that Chinese temples and Japanese ones after them are laid out with seven buildings arranged like a human body. And guess where you have to enter? The mountain gate. Yeah, I thought you'd enjoy that. All right. So tonight, vow. The power of vows. All right. A fundamental energy of transformation. Well, is this so? We get to ask. We get to wonder. And we do wonder. Every time we begin a discussion of vows, the question comes up. Well, they're impossible. The statement comes up, they're impossible. The second, how would I ever do this? Third, why would I ever do this? Fourth, why am I doing this? Which comes shortly after, why would I do this? And so I thought, let's at least, number one, we'll start with that pesky question, what's a vow? Yeah? And never mind, we're not going to answer that question because it wouldn't even make sense to answer that. It's not useful to answer that question. So what we are going to do, for one reason, actually, well, you only need one reason, which is what a vow is exists only in the heart mind of the vower. Yeah? It's invisible and inexpressible. So why waste time trying to define it? It's not an it, is it? But we can consider some for instances. You know, we can say what we can notice what it's like instead of what it is. So musing on this a little bit, you know, it can just be a decision sometimes, right? Like, I'm not going to do that again. You know, I have a memorable one from my own life where I once spanked my 3-year-old daughter one whack because she put the baby kittens' faces into the cat litter. And she was smushing the little baby kittens' faces into them. And I lost it. I whacked her. And at that point, I said to myself, I'm not doing that again. I witnessed myself losing it, you know? And that was just a decision. It was not like coming from any great philosophical base or any beliefs about spankings. It was just not doing that again. So that can happen. Or I'm going to be on time. I'm not going to be late. And then that can happen. That can be a lifelong change. Or in our family, we don't call names. Does that sound familiar to anybody? But that kind of communal agreement, whether it's made by everybody or instituted by one, can become an unspoken vow of a lifetime, can't it? It's just, yeah, we just don't do that. Yeah? Or we don't drink sodas, or we don't throw away stuff that can be recycled, or we say please and thank you. You know, it's a decision. And it's a kind of vow, actually, if you think about it. And sometimes, of course, vows are made for us. So if you think about that one, you know, how early do we learn please and thank you? Like, we're pre-verbal already when that comes up, you know. We say pee and thank, or tank, or something like it, you know. And so, and if thinking about a christening where parents are making vows, it's very odd to look at it, you know, that parent is making a vow for a baby sometimes. And so what's that? That's very interesting and problematic. But then also I thought about Jimmy Carter, you know, in his old age. And I don't have a quote from him, but you've read them, you know. And it's not like he's taking some sort of solemn vow. It's just like, well, I'm still alive, so I think I'll build houses, you know. But that's a kind of vow. It's just not one with a lot of trumpets blaring at it. And then all the way to Shantideva, and I'll read just a little bit of it, you know, of the way of Bodhisattva. Thus, by the virtue collected through all that I have done, may the pain of every living creature be completely cleared away. May I be the doctor and the medicine, and may I be the nurse for all sick beings in the world until everyone is healed. May a rain of food and drink descend to clear away the pain of thirst and hunger. And during the eon of famine, may I myself change into food and drink. Yeah, all the way to there. But what about our vows that we recite and that we practice and that we take as our precepts and wear them on our chests? And what about those that we are so concerned about them, you know, we're concerned about the impossibility of them, you know, and do we know what they mean and how, what do we do with them, you know? What about those? So an interesting thing happened today, just oddly, after lunch, feeling a little adrift or something, or I don't know what I was feeling. I decided to open I Ching and consult the oracle. And you can do it as a very open-ended kind of question. So I asked the ancestors which is the way I learned to use I Ching, if they wanted to talk to me. And I asked for a picture of my situation. I wasn't asking to do this or that. I was asking just for a picture of my situation. And this evening, all of a sudden, I realized it was answering for all of us. It actually was answering our situation, not my situation. But anyway, so I use marbles in a jade bowl that a former student gave me, and the red orange sort of blood colored marbles are the yang ones,
are the
yang lines. Okay, so I'm just, you know, I hold them for a little bit and I scramble them around and I pick one out and it's red, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I scramble them around and let them feel my fingers and pull them out and it's red. Are you starting to get the drift to this? Here's the hexagram. So this is hexagram number one of the I Ching. And it is heaven or dragon over heaven or dragon. And the reading is inspiring force, dragon. And I'm going to read you a few of the words because I thought, wow, you know, I knew when I did the reading that we were going to be talking tonight about the power of vow. And the reading is power. And some of the words that are in the reading are creative energy, dynamic power that guides and inspires, persist, endure, untiring, the shape changer, the rainmaker, the yang force awakening life, the daimon who brings the protection of the ancestors, the power of the inner images. And promotes seeing or visualizing, a gate to the unseen, conductor of blessings, the awesome power of the other, the ancestor. Your situation is full of inspiring force. Offer yourself to the process. Persist and take action. Be dynamic, strong, untiring, tenacious, enduring. Have no fear. Ride the power of the dragon and bring the fertilizing rain. You can open up a whole new circle of time.
Time?
What we're doing here is not small stuff. You get the picture. Interestingly, there's one more piece I would read to you. There were no changing lines. There were no relating figures. For those of you who use I Ching, it was just boom. This right here. But this manual that I use from Stephen Karcher includes relating figures that look at the inner and the outer trigrams, which give you a sense of the dynamic of something. And the inner and outer trigrams of this are still the same reading because it's all the same lines. But there's there are figures for the ideal and the shadow. So the ideal way to work with the situation and what's not so good. And this is kind of interesting. And it says, think of this, for the ideal, think of this as a time to open a still space within which old life is brought to an end and its lessons learned. You will be entangled in the shadows if you focus on preparing a decisive new move now. Let go of this need, and the preparation will occur of itself. Hmm. Do you want me to read that again?
Yes, please.
Think of this as a time to open a still space. That's what we do here, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Within where, he says within where, I can't quite handle that grammar. Within which old life is brought to an end and its lessons learned. This feels to me like the purification part of our process, of our vows process, and the purification part of our retreat process. And this first, is this the first full day? This is the second full day? So this second full day. What?
Not the second week.
The second week. But you might notice somewhere in these first couple of days yourself going through a process of purification where a whole lot of stuff comes up. And it always happens to me in a retreat, and I don't know about you, but where there's a kind of purging. And it's not so much content, it just seems like it just has to happen. There has to be a grieving, there has to be a releasing, there has to be a going through, going through the storm. Yes, it doesn't always happen, but it very often does. And I thought, this is interesting to have this show up in here. Think of this as a time to open a still space within which old life is brought to an end and its lessons learned. You will be entangled in the shadows if you focus on preparing a decisive new move now. Remember at the beginning of the retreat, I gave you that. Please don't try to make this retreat do work for you, right? Don't be focused on outcomes. Don't be trying to make the retreat help you do the next thing. That's what I hear echoed in this reading. Let the retreat simply be itself. You open the space and you see what happens. You hold that space and you keep on opening it, right? You keep on letting the retreat do what it does. Letting practice do what it does. So you'll be entangled in the shadows if you focus on preparing a decisive new move now. Let go of this need, and the preparation will occur of itself. Isn't that interesting? Let go of the need, let go of the compulsion to get on with it, right? And the preparation will be happening already in the dark where you don't have to see it necessarily. And you don't control it for sure. Anyway, is that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
To have that be today's... okay. So the power of vows, is it so? We actually have a number of koans and commentaries on this. But I'm, with your, I hope, forgiveness, going to bring in a koan that is familiar both to many of you, both recently and in the past, but it doesn't matter whether you have or haven't ever met this koan. I'm going to read it, and I'm going to read a variation of it, and I want to look at it from this angle, right, from where we are right now, And I'd like to put next to it the image from the 10th ox herding picture. Are you familiar with the ox herding pictures?
No.
Okay. They are a set of 10 pictures that depict the spiritual journey from China and Japan. And so they start out with a little person kind of lost in the wilderness and listening intently but hearing only crickets. Which is so funny because that expression is so... And what did you hear? Crickets. You know? And then finding some tracks down by the riverside and following tracks of a big ox, following the tracks, eventually finding the ox and being blown away by the power of this magnificent animal, and then going about taming, catching, and then taming the ox, in which process the ox actually tames the kid just as much as the kid tames the ox. And then we find the little person sitting backwards, playing a flute, riding the ox home. And then ox and little person at ease, at home. And then no ox, no person, big old emptiness. And then riverside, red flower blooming, things reappearing as themselves, and finally the now old little person, barefoot and in rags and carrying a huge sack of goodies, and sort of kicking up towards the moon, entering the town with the sack of goodies and everything blooming, dead trees blooming behind. So it's that image that I wanted to bring in, the image of the our wayfarer returning to the village with everything blooming behind. Yeah? Okay. So here's our story for tonight. The woman at the Pilgrim's Inn. So first version. There was a woman who kept the Pilgrim's Inn at Hara under Mount Fuji. Her name is unknown, and it's not known when she was born or died. She went to hear a talk by Hakuin, who said, "They say there's a pure land where everything is only mind, and that there's a Buddha of light in your own body." Once that Buddha of light appears, mountains, rivers, earth, grass, trees, and forests suddenly glow with a great light. To see this, you have to look inside your own heart. Then what should you be looking out for? When you're looking for something inside your own heart, for that Buddha of light inside your own heart, what kind of special features would it have? When you're looking for the Buddha of infinite light in your own body, how would you recognize it? Are you hearing me?
Mostly.
Mostly, okay. I'll try to be a little bit louder. When she heard this, so those two questions, right? What special features would it have? How would you recognize it? They're good questions, aren't they? If you're looking for the Buddha of infinite light inside your own body, what are you actually looking for? How are you going to recognize it? When she heard this, the woman said, "This isn't so hard." Back at home, she meditated day and night, holding the question while she was awake and during her sleep. One day, as she was washing the pot, she had a sudden breakthrough. She threw the pot aside and rushed to see Hakuin. She said, "I've met Buddha in my own body, and everything on earth is shining with a great light. It's wonderful." She danced for joy. "Is that so?" said Hakuin. He said that about just about everything, right? He said that when they brought him somebody else's baby to take on too, right? And said it was his. Is that so? But what about a pile of shit? Does it also shine with a great light? The woman ran up and slapped him. She said, "You still don't get it, you old fart." And Hakuin roared with laughter. I brought copies of this for you to take this evening. But I want to read you this second version, which is slightly different. So with the background story that Hakuin, he was such an amazing one of our ancestors. He was a very, very tough master in the monastery. You know, he was known for having extremely high standards and bashing mercilessly any other teacher that he thought was teaching the wrong stuff. You can read it. It's like, whoa, you know. What were some of his epithets? Do you remember, Frank? It's like, "Oh, they're just turtles swimming around in the mud at the bottom of the sea," you know. he was just unrestrained in his criticism. But he was known to people in his area as the kindest guy and a very gentle teacher. And in the area, what was being practiced was Pure Land Buddhism. So the emphasis in Pure Land Buddhism is on not thinking that you're just going to do, as I understand it, is not thinking you're going to get enlightened all by your lonesome, but relying on other power and calling on the Buddha of infinite light, Amitabha Buddha, to save you. And that if you recite Namo Amida Butsu, over and over and over and over, day and night, sort of like the Christian pray without ceasing. You know, if you do this prayer constantly, then you will be reborn in the Pure Land. Well, Hakuin was concerned about that part, about the "you'll get reborn in the Pure Land" part. And so he was using skillful means to help people get the sense that this Buddha of infinite light is already here, mm-hmm. right? And it's if you think about this very place is the Lotus Land, this very, or is paradise, used to say the Lotus Land, this very body, the Buddha, right? There it is, boom, in something we recite all the time. Mm-hmm. So this version, it says, one morning, an old lady, so now we have a different view of the woman who kept pilgrims in, she's described here as an old lady, experienced an awakening while cleaning up after breakfast. She rushed over and announced to Hakuin, "Amida has engulfed my body. The universe radiates. How truly marvelous." "Nonsense," Hakuin retorted. "Does it shine up your asshole?" The tiny old lady gave Hakuin a shove and shouted, "What do you know about enlightenment?" And they both roared with laughter. So just, you know, not very different, but with a little bit of a different flavor. Yeah. And I was particularly interested in the Amida has engulfed my body, that different language, yeah. And so now I want to circle back for a minute and make the connection with that last ox herding picture, because there's an interesting question in here, right? She says, "I've met the Buddha of infinite light in my own body, and everything on earth is shining with a great light." I think it's easy for us to think that that shining is in the eye of the beholder.
In the eye?
Of the beholder, in her eye. And that is to reject the possibility that everything really is now shining with a great light, which reminds me of one of the versions of what Siddhartha said when he was lit by the morning star, right? I and everything else are now awakened. And presenting that as a reality, not like I'm awakened so I see everything else, the beauty of everything else. I and everything are awakened at this moment. And I wonder whether her everything is shining with a great light is I'm shining, everything is shining, not because I can see the light, I see it everywhere, right? So I just wanted to kind of leave that, or maybe it's not an either or, you know. I guess I don't have to make an either or out of it, do I? But I just wanted to kind of raise that because here's the more interesting question. Does this have anything to do with a vow? There is no mention of a vow in the koan. What does she say when she hears him ask those questions, when he poses those questions? What does she say?
This is easy.
This isn't so hard. How's that for a vow? I love it. I think that's my favorite vow. Because that's acknowledging the power, right? This isn't so hard means the power is here. And here is somebody who probably has been reciting the name, has been reciting Namu Amida Butsu, relying on other power. She's saying, this isn't so hard. I just think there's something gorgeous about that, you know? That the practice that's been ongoing for her has been her steady practice, her ongoing vow. As a woman in that community, there's power. And there certainly is power in saying this isn't so hard. Yeah. So those questions, I think, are really worth hanging with if you want to, if they call to you. And that's why I'm handing it out to everybody at the end of the evening. Those questions about, so to read again Hakuin's talk, they say there's a pure land where everything is only mind. These days, I think we would say everything is made of consciousness. That they say, right? There's a pure land where everything is made of consciousness, and that there's a Buddha of light in your own body. Once that Buddha of light appears, mountains, rivers, earth, grass, trees, and forests suddenly glow with a great light. To see this, you have to look inside your own heart. Then, what should you be looking out for? When you're looking for something that is only mind, what kind of special features would it have? When you're looking for the Buddha of infinite light in your own body, how would you recognize it? Buddha just meaning awakened one, right?
Mm-hmm. Just meaning what?
Just meaning awake one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So if you allow yourself not to worry too much about meaning, about making sense, when we are sitting, if we are just looking, if we are just listening, and I like listening, I usually say listening a lot more than looking, because looking so often is looking for, whereas listening is omnidirectional and not so purposeful. So what if you, instead of looking for the Buddha of infinite light, what if you're listening? What if you're listening for the Buddha of infinite light? And when you're sitting deep in your meditation, do you worry very much about inside your body or outside your body? What's inside your body? Everything, right? Pretty much. Once you settle in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So if you're looking and listening, and you don't have any other thing to do, because after all, you don't have a job when you're sitting, except that. Or when you're walking, or when you're doing your job, for that matter, since everything in retreat is meditation, right? And which she knew, right? She wasn't going to stop. And she didn't take any special vow, but it sure has the quality of vow, doesn't it? When you read, when she heard this, she said, "This isn't so hard." Back at home, she meditated day and night.
Right.
Yeah, don't you love it? This is hard. So she meditated day and night, holding the question while she was awake and during her sleep and washing the dishes and,
right.
And the sheets.
Right?
Yeah. Okay. So, what special features would it have? Okay? So that goes with us. And and I think that's, and the rest of the book is empty.
Waiting
for tomorrow.
Did you pay extra for that?
So, we could have some conversation. We have a little time. But I also brought a couple poems that seem to me, in their sideways manner, to connect. Right, so maybe it would be good not to have conversation tonight, but just to hear a poem or two and then sit. Okay, let's do that.
Do you have papers to hand out?
Yeah, and I'll give them to you.
Okay.
gosh, this is the hard part, is choosing which one, because I think two is going to be too much. I think it wants just one. And one of them is longer than the other one.
Especially when we ask you to do it twice.
We're not reading this one.
Especially when we ask you to do it twice.
Well, I think maybe, maybe I'll do this one. John Tarrant introduced us to this poet, Tony Hoagland. He's not alive anymore. Mm-hmm. Did you already know him before that? Mm. He's wonderful. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to read, I'm not going to read the title poem, which, although the title is so wonderful, Priest Turns Turned Therapist Treats Fear of God. But this is not that poem. It's called Entangle. And this is for you. because of something he said today.
Oh,
Steve. Entangle. Sometimes I prefer not to untangle it. So this actually really does follow what we just did, because if you're looking for the Buddha of infinite light and listening for the Buddha of infinite light, don't think you have to untangle it. That would be my advice. Because it is richer that way. Sometimes I prefer not to untangle it. I prefer it to remain disorganized. Because it is richer that way. Like a certain shrubbery that I pass each day on Reba Street, in an unimpressive yard, in front of a house that seems unoccupied. A chest-high spreading shrub with large, white, waxy blossoms, whose stalks are climbed and woven through simultaneously by a different kind of vine with small magenta flowers that appear and disappear inside the maze of leaves, like tiny purple stitches. The white and purple combination of these species, one seeming so possibly to be strangling the other, one possibly lifting the other up. It would take both a botanist and a psychologist to figure it all out. But I prefer not to disentangle it because it is more accurate. My ferocious love, and how it repeatedly is trapped inside my fear of being sentimental. My need to control even the kindness of the world, rejecting gifts for which I am not prepared. My apparently inextinguishable notion that I am moving toward a destination. I could probably untangle it, yet I prefer to walk down Reba Street instead, in the sunlight and the wind, with no mastery of my feelings or my thoughts. Purple and ivory and green, not understanding what I am, and yet in certain moments remembering and bursting into tears. Somewhat confused as the vines run through me and flower unexpectedly.
Sarah, that was written for John Tarrant.
Oh.
At the back of the book it says it was written for him by the poet.
Huh.
And what's the author's name?
Tony Hoagland. It's H-O-A-G-L-A-N-D.